Cambridge Certificate of Proficiency in English Listening Test. Ahead Books. Written by Sean Houghton. Test 7. I'm going to give you the instructions for this test. I shall introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you will hear this sound. You will hear each piece twice. Remember, while you're listening, write your answers on the question paper. You will have 5 minutes at the end of the real test to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. In the exam, there would now be a pause. Please ask any questions you have during the pause, because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. You will hear three different extracts. For questions 1 to 6, choose the answer A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are 2 questions for each extract. Extract 1. You will hear a psychology professor called Humphrey lecturing on the subject of happiness.
Can you really talk yourself into being happy? Well, perhaps it's not quite as simple as that. However, don't dismiss the notion too lightly. There is indeed a great amount to be said for positive thinking. For a start, the opposite is what can lead us into a rut. This occurs when we dwell overly on the negative things impacting or happening in our lives. Doing so is entirely counterproductive, however. As the saying goes, worrying about them won't make your troubles go away. Indeed, it will do far worse than that. It will compound them and make the situation seem more and more overwhelming if you continue to think in such a way for a prolonged period of time. On the other hand, trying to find the upside to the situation allows you to break out of the cycle of negativity. Whilst this won't disappear your problems as such, it will ensure they are not compounded, and, furthermore, will put you in the best frame of mind possible to resolve them. But here is something else to ponder. People often make snide remarks about those who deliberately try to be overly positive, suggesting they are trying to convince themselves that they are happy. My point is this. If you do manage to convince yourself that you are happy, well, are you not actually so? Only you have to believe it, no one else. So, snide remarks aside, I would be a very strong advocate of positive thinking. The delusion of happiness, as some would claim, can perhaps become something entirely more tangible if you give this way of thinking a proper chance. Can you really talk yourself into being happy? Well, perhaps it's not quite as simple as that. However, don't dismiss the notion too lightly. There is indeed a great amount to be said for positive thinking. For a start, the opposite is what can lead us into a rut. This occurs when we dwell overly on the negative things impacting or happening in our lives. Doing so is entirely counterproductive, however. As the saying goes, worrying about them won't make your troubles go away. Indeed, it will do far worse than that. It will compound them and make the situation seem more and more overwhelming if you continue to think in such a way for a prolonged period of time. On the other hand, trying to find the upside to the situation allows you to break out of the cycle of negativity. Whilst this won't disappear your problems as such, it will ensure they are not compounded, and, furthermore, will put you in the best frame of mind possible to resolve them. But here is something else to ponder. People often make snide remarks about those who deliberately try to be overly positive, suggesting they are trying to convince themselves that they are happy. My point is this. if you do manage to convince yourself that you are happy, well, are you not actually so? Only you have to believe it, no one else. So, snide remarks aside, I would be a very strong advocate of positive thinking. The delusion of happiness, as some would claim, can perhaps become something entirely more tangible if you give this way of thinking a proper chance.
Extract 2. You will hear a formerly homeless woman called Eleanor being interviewed on the radio.
Eleanor, how did you end up on the streets? And more importantly, how did you manage to turn your life around?
Well, I can already hear people shaking their heads at what I'm about to say and the usual chorus of no's. However, based on personal experience, it is my belief that anyone can end up in my position, even high-flying business people. Of course, I was not such myself, but I did have a very comfortable life. I cannot pinpoint the moment everything started to go wrong, but when my life did begin to unravel, I felt powerless to prevent my further descent into the abyss.
And so, before you knew it, you were sleeping in doorways. Is that right?
Yes, that's pretty accurate.
So, how did you find your way back?
Well, this is a little less difficult to pinpoint. Indeed, I know the exact moment. When one is filled with hopelessness, life seems very difficult indeed, and you begin to lose faith in humanity. I had lost all faith until one bitter winter's night, with my hands getting frostnip, when I could barely endure the severe weather any longer. Out of nowhere, a young woman, barely half my age, came up to me with a hot drink. Not in and of itself unusual, but she looked me straight in the eye and spoke softly to me, saying, "Why don't you go home, love? You know they're probably waiting for you. Everything will be all right." Then she hugged me and left. The words stuck in my mind. I sucked up my remaining pride and re-engaged with the world and asked for help. And here I am today.
Eleanor, how did you end up on the streets? And more importantly, how did you manage to turn your life around?
Well, I can already hear people shaking their heads at what I'm about to say and the usual chorus of no's. However, based on personal experience, it is my belief that anyone can end up in my position, even high-flying business people. Of course, I was not such myself, but I did have a very comfortable life. I cannot pinpoint the moment everything started to go wrong, but when my life did begin to unravel, I felt powerless to prevent my further descent into the abyss.
And so, before you knew it, you were sleeping in doorways. Is that right?
Yes, that's pretty accurate.
So, how did you find your way back?
Well, this is a little less difficult to pinpoint. Indeed, I know the exact moment. When one is filled with hopelessness, life seems very difficult indeed, and you begin to lose faith in humanity. I had lost all faith until one bitter winter's night, with my hands getting frostnip, when I could barely endure the severe weather any longer. Out of nowhere, a young woman, barely half my age, came up to me with a hot drink. Not in and of itself unusual, but she looked me straight in the eye and spoke softly to me, saying, "Why don't you go home, love? You know they're probably waiting for you. Everything will be all right." Then she hugged me and left. The words stuck in my mind. I sucked up my remaining pride and re-engaged with the world and asked for help. And here I am today.
Extract 3. You will hear a lecturer called Philippa discussing the housing market.
Talking about the housing market makes for a depressing conversation these days. It irks me most when I hear middle-aged people saying to the younger generation, "Well, it was the same for us when we wanted to get onto the property ladder." Actually, it most certainly was not. Whilst buying a first property has never been a piece of cake as such, the challenge in the past was not nearly as daunting as it is today. Past generations, of course, still had to get mortgages, and at times, interest rates on repayments were very high indeed compared to the favourable ones we enjoy today. But the notion that housing used to be more affordable is not fanciful by any means. That was actually the case. There is a reason why the average age of first-time housebuyers continues to rise steadily and is now closing in on the 40 years of age mark. That's because house prices, relative to salary, have never been higher. So, unfortunately, not only is it harder to buy a house, it's also harder to make the repayments, despite the favourable interest rates. Indeed, most young people today are priced out of the housing market altogether and can only get onto the property market through the bank of mum and dad if they're lucky. Either mum and dad fork out the deposit, or they guarantee the mortgage, meaning they will pay for it if their child defaults, or indeed, in some cases, both. Times for young house buyers are very tough for sure. Talking about the housing market makes for a depressing conversation these days. It irks me most when I hear middle-aged people saying to the younger generation, "Well, it was the same for us when we wanted to get onto the property ladder." Actually, it most certainly was not. Whilst buying a first property has never been a piece of cake as such, the challenge in the past was not nearly as daunting as it is today. Past generations, of course, still had to get mortgages, and at times, interest rates on repayments were very high indeed compared to the favourable ones we enjoy today. But the notion that housing used to be more affordable is not fanciful by any means. That was actually the case. There is a reason why the average age of first-time housebuyers continues to rise steadily and is now closing in on the 40 years of age mark. That's because house prices, relative to salary, have never been higher. So, unfortunately, not only is it harder to buy a house, it's also harder to make the repayments, despite the favourable interest rates. Indeed, most young people today are priced out of the housing market altogether and can only get onto the property market through the bank of mum and dad if they're lucky. Either mum and dad fork out the deposit, or they guarantee the mortgage, meaning they will pay for it if their child defaults, or indeed, in some cases, both. Times for young house buyers are very tough for sure.
That is the end of part one. Now turn to part two. You will hear a radio presenter called Finbar Baird discussing reports in the news about firstborn children being the smartest siblings. For questions 7 to 15, complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part two.
Welcome back to Today with Finbar Baird. Now, next up, I want to have a look at what's in the news, and one of the things that really caught my eye and indeed rubbed me up the wrong way this week is the way the results of new research by scientists into child performance have been reported. It is not the research itself that I take issue with, nor is it the main body content of the news reports either. However, I find the headlines that have been used extremely misleading. For instance, one paper leads with the following, and I quote, "Firstborn children are smarter than their siblings." This clearly implies that the first child is more intelligent than any subsequent children born into the same family. yet that is not what the research suggests at all. Contrarily, the research found that firstborn children have a tendency to perform better in their education. Note the distinction. Perform better does not necessarily equate to being more intelligent. Indeed, the research specifically cited not higher innate intelligence, but the fact that firstborns receive more attention from their parents as the reason for their superior educational performance. And actually, when you reflect on it, this makes perfect sense. After all, a first child is a big deal for any new family, and young parents are often understandably nervous, so they devote an extra special amount of time to the firstborn and making sure they do the best they can with its upbringing. When the next child comes along, they are perhaps, naturally, slightly more relaxed, as they have been there before, as it were, so whether intentionally or otherwise, they give a little less of themselves to the child-raising process and put slightly less effort in. The data, which was collected from thousands of families over the course of more than a decade, confirms this. It found that parents tend to do fewer activities with their second child and subsequent children, reading less to them, not encouraging them to do art and crafts or music as much, and so on. This extra focus that firstborns receive in their early childhood gives them the edge over their younger siblings. The advantage is evident in children as young as 1 year old, and it shows up time and again in IQ tests. Indeed, the research goes a long way towards explaining a phenomenon scientists call birth order effect, whereby children born earlier into a family with numerous siblings tend to have a superior chance of enjoying better wages and greater educational achievement in life. It must be stressed, however, that the report does not accuse parents of being neglectful towards second-born and later children. Indeed, the research suggests all children in a family tend to receive equal amounts of emotional support. It is just the intellectual stimulation that is sometimes lacking for younger siblings. And in fact, there are logical explanations for why this might be so. After all, two children is twice the work of one for parents, and so on. Clearly, parents cannot devote all their time to a second-born child in the same way they could the first-born when it arrived, because they are still caring for the first-born, so the time and effort must be shared between the children. As I said, I find the research interesting, and I think it confirms a lot of what we already intuitively know and logically would understand. However, what irks me is the shabby reporting, so I would like to clarify once and for all, in no way does the research suggest that firstborns are innately more intelligent than their later siblings. It only suggests that they perform better on average because they receive more attention in their early childhood. In other words, the additional intellectual stimuli they are exposed to early on give them a better chance of succeeding. Speaking as a parent, though, I think there is much we can learn from this.
Now you will hear part two again.
Welcome back to Today with Finbar Baird. Now, next up, I want to have a look at what's in the news, and one of the things that really caught my eye, and indeed rubbed me up the wrong way this week, is the way the results of new research by scientists into child performance have been reported. It is not the research itself that I take issue with, nor is it the main body content of the news reports either. However, I find the headlines that have been used extremely misleading. For instance, one paper leads with the following, and I quote, "Firstborn children are smarter than their siblings." This clearly implies that the first child is more intelligent than any subsequent children born into the same family. Yet that is not what the research suggests at all. Contrarily, the research found that firstborn children have a tendency to perform better in their education. Note the distinction. Perform better does not necessarily equate to being more intelligent. Indeed, the research specifically cited not higher innate intelligence, but the fact that firstborns receive more attention from their parents as the reason for their superior educational performance. And actually, when you reflect on it, this makes perfect sense. After all, a first child is a big deal for any new family, and young parents are often understandably nervous, so they devote an extra special amount of time to the firstborn and making sure they do the best they can with its upbringing. When the next child comes along, they are perhaps, naturally, slightly more relaxed, as they have been there before, as it were, so whether intentionally or otherwise, they give a little less of themselves to the child-raising process and put slightly less effort in. The data, which was collected from thousands of families over the course of more than a decade, confirms this. It found that parents tend to do fewer activities with their second child and subsequent children, reading less to them, not encouraging them to do art and crafts or music as much, and so on. This extra focus that firstborns receive in their early childhood gives them the edge over their younger siblings. The advantage is evident in children as young as 1 year old, and it shows up time and again in IQ tests. Indeed, the research goes a long way towards explaining a phenomenon scientists call birth order effect, whereby children born earlier into a family with numerous siblings tend to have a superior chance of enjoying better wages and greater educational achievement in life. It must be stressed, however, that the report does not accuse parents of being neglectful towards second-born and later children. Indeed, the research suggests all children in a family tend to receive equal amounts of emotional support. It is just the intellectual stimulation that is sometimes lacking for younger siblings. And in fact, there are logical explanations for why this might be so. After all, two children is twice the work of one for parents, and so on. Clearly, parents cannot devote all their time to a second-born child in the same way they could the first-born when it arrived, because they are still caring for the first-born, so the time and effort must be shared between the children. As I said, I find the research interesting, and I think it confirms a lot of what we already intuitively know and logically would understand. However, what irks me is the shabby reporting, so I would like to clarify once and for all, in no way does the research suggest that firstborns are innately more intelligent than their later siblings. It only suggests that they perform better on average because they receive more attention in their early childhood. In other words, the additional intellectual stimuli they are exposed to early on give them a better chance of succeeding. Speaking as a parent, though, I think there is much we can learn from this.
That is the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You will hear a radio program in which two people, Max Verstapp and Cara O'Dell, are discussing amateur photography. For questions 16 to 20, choose the answer A, B, C or D, which fits best according to what you hear. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part three.
A warm welcome to Max Verstapp and Cara O'Dell, who join me on today's episode of Camera in Focus to offer their insights and advice for would-be photographers out there. Cara, as a professional photographer, I'd like to turn to you first. What advice do you have for amateurs just starting out? Photography, after all, can be a very expensive game.
There is no disputing that, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. There are, for example, some wonderful second-hand options on the market. and it is possible to get your mitts on some really good equipment at an excellent price.
I think that's sage advice from Cara, actually. This must sound strange coming from the owner of a camera shop, but I would advise against amateurs spending big money on equipment until they get a feel for what they really want to get out of their photography. Second-hand is definitely one excellent route down which to go. However, bear in mind that advances in technology have made the impossible possible, so to speak, in the field of photography today, and even cheaper new camera units can produce some quite impressive results. I'd lean towards recommending this latter option.
Indeed, Max has a point. Even the mobile phone cannot be totally dismissed anymore. Some of the latest models can rival even expensive purpose-built cameras for everyday purposes. However, they have their limitations, and there remains no substitute for specialist equipment if you desire the best results.
Absolutely, Cara. My point is, find your feet and find the area that appeals to you before spending on the relevant equipment. Experiment first. Find your niche.
Okay, so, mobile phones aside, what kind of camera would you recommend for a novice photographer?
Well, ideally, a cheap DSLR. That's a camera that lets you change the lens for different purposes. There are some excellent value ones on the market now, especially second-hand.
I would be hesitant about recommending the DSLR, actually. Notwithstanding the high-quality images even cheaper models can produce, I think new photographers can be somewhat put off by their seeming complexity, and also, more crucially, by having to carry a lot of kit, for example, numerous different lenses.
I'm glad Max used the word seeming, because the level of effort it takes to familiarise yourself with the workings of a DSLR is not gargantuan by any means.
No, that's true, Cara, but personally I would favour a single-lens camera, something a bit more versatile and portable. For example, a bridge camera. These tend to be slightly more affordable than DSLRs, yet they have most of the same functionality, allowing users to experiment and become familiar with different camera settings without being overawed.
What about compact system cameras? Are these any good?
Oh, without question. Indeed, the higher-end ones are replacing the DSLRs in the kit of many a professional photographer today. However, they tend to be out of most people's price range. A mid-range compact camera, however, is comparatively expensive when compared to a second-hand DSLR or new bridge camera. Therefore, I would personally go with one of these instead.
Yes, Cara. Again, I think the trick is not to invest heavily until you understand what you want to get out of photography. I would caution against the low-end compact system cameras. The build and image quality are dubious, but it's true that mid-range and upwards, the quality is unquestioned. However, why fork out on one of them when there are inexpensive alternatives that yield similar results, such as the two options we have mentioned already?
Is there anything to be said for your average point-and-shoot camera these days, Max?
Well, from the point of view that anything that gets people out and about taking shots and experimenting is a good thing, they have their merits. I would say on a par with a mobile phone camera, for example, which, incidentally, begs the question, why buy something that you already have? However, I think realistically for those wanting to advance their skills, there are better avenues into photography that are just as affordable.
I would echo Max's sentiments there, really, and add that the best way to go...
Now you will hear part three again.
A warm welcome to Max Verstappen and Cara O'Dell, who join me on today's episode of Camera in Focus to offer their insights and advice for would-be photographers out there. Cara, as a professional photographer, I'd like to turn to you first. What advice do you have for amateurs just starting out? Photography, after all, can be a very expensive game.
There is no disputing that, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. There are, for example, some wonderful second-hand options on the market, and it is possible to get your mitts on some really good equipment at an excellent price.
I think that's sage advice from Cara, actually. This must sound strange coming from the owner of a camera shop, but I would advise against amateurs spending big money on equipment until they get a feel for what they really want to get out of their photography. Second-hand is definitely one excellent route down which to go. However, bear in mind that advances in technology have made the impossible possible, so to speak, in the field of photography today, and even cheaper new camera units can produce some quite impressive results. I'd lean towards recommending this latter option.
Indeed, Max has a point. Even the mobile phone cannot be totally dismissed anymore. Some of the latest models can rival even expensive purpose-built cameras for everyday purposes. However, they have their limitations, and there remains no substitute for specialist equipment if you desire the best results.
Absolutely, Cara. My point is, find your feet and find the area that appeals to you before spending on the relevant equipment. Experiment first. Find your niche.
Okay, so, mobile phones aside, what kind of camera would you recommend for a novice photographer?
Well, ideally, a cheap DSLR. That's a camera that lets you change the lens for different purposes. There are some excellent value ones on the market now, especially second-hand.
I would be hesitant about recommending the DSLR, actually. Notwithstanding the high-quality images even cheaper models can produce, I think new photographers can be somewhat put off by their seeming complexity, and also, more crucially, by having to carry a lot of kit, for example, numerous different lenses.
I'm glad Max used the word seeming, because the level of effort it takes to familiarise yourself with the workings of a DSLR is not gargantuan by any means.
No, that's true, Cara, but personally I would favour a single-lens camera, something a bit more versatile and portable. For example, a bridge camera. These tend to be slightly more affordable than DSLRs, yet they have most of the same functionality, allowing users to experiment and become familiar with different camera settings without being overawed.
What about compact system cameras? Are these any good?
Oh, without question. Indeed, the higher-end ones are replacing the DSLRs in the kit of many a professional photographer today. However, they tend to be out of most people's price range. A mid-range compact camera, however, is comparatively expensive when compared to a second-hand DSLR or new bridge camera. Therefore, I would personally go with one of these instead.
Yes, Cara. Again, I think the trick is not to invest heavily until you understand what you want to get out of photography. I would caution against the low-end compact system cameras. The build and image quality are dubious, but it's true that mid-range and upwards, the quality is unquestioned. However, why fork out on one of them when there are inexpensive alternatives that yield similar results, such as the two options we have mentioned already?
Is there anything to be said for your average point-and-shoot camera these days, Max?
Well, from the point of view that anything that gets people out and about taking shots and experimenting is a good thing, they have their merits. I would say on a par with a mobile phone camera, for example, which, incidentally, begs the question, why buy something that you already have? However, I think realistically for those wanting to advance their skills, there are better avenues into photography that are just as affordable.
I would echo Max's sentiments there, really, and add that the best way to go...
That is the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. Part 4 consists of two tasks. You will hear 5 short extracts in which people talk about their commute to work. Look at task 1. For questions 21 to 25, choose from the list A to H how each speaker feels about commuting. Now look at task 2. For questions 26 to 30, choose from the list A to H what each speaker says about their future commute. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 4. Speaker 1.
I don't mind my commute per se, despite the amount of time I spend getting to work and back each day. Some would say it is incredibly wasteful and unproductive to sit on a train for 2 hours every morning and evening. However, I think you have to make the best of every situation, and while mine is not by any means ideal, I try to use my time constructively. For example, I'm learning a language using listening aids at the moment while I commute, and this has the added bonus of distracting me from all the surrounding commotion, which I would otherwise find at times very unsettling. I am not massively at home in large crowds, but, as I said already, it is important to make the best of things, and for the foreseeable future, I am stuck with my commute. Thus, I have to cope with it as best I can until things change, maybe in a year or so.
Speaker 2.
I actually miss my old route to work now that I no longer have to catch the 6:30 train in every morning. Indeed, I'm incredibly anxious about whether or not I will lose some of the network of friends I had built up while commuting. We were commuter buddies, it was great, partners in crime and suffering together. Though for me it wasn't suffering at all, but an absolute pleasure and a wonderful opportunity to interact with people. My nerves are fraying now and I fear for my social life. All of my best mates commute and I see them much less now than I used to. It's going to take an incredible effort on my part to maintain those links, where before it was so natural. Ironically, I'll probably end up having to do a lot of commuting of a different sort, for social and not work purposes. It's the only option I have left, as my move to the city centre is permanent. After all, I bought a house here.
Speaker 3.
I am fed up of having to listen to what others are doing on the train. Has the entire world gone deaf? Is it really necessary to have your speakers turned up so loud? One day, the guy next to me is learning French, no less, and the next I'm listening to some hard rock nonsense. Sometimes I want to strangle them, really. Though that's not the most intrusive thing. Worse still is when the person beside me starts trying to start up a conversation. I'll never fathom why people think I would want to be all social on my commute to work. For starters, I'm not a morning person, so my main priority is to use the time constructively to get a bit of extra shut-eye. Otherwise, I'll arrive at work grumpy and make my work colleagues nervous. I think a permanent move closer to my place of work for a reduced commute is very necessary for my sanity, and I am taking measures as we speak to make that a reality imminently.
Speaker 4.
I'm inquisitive by nature, so I must say I find the commute to work intriguing. Seldom will you ever have the opportunity to observe and learn so much about other people and the way they behave. There are the nervous types, who are patently uncomfortable and wishing they were anywhere else. Then there are the ones who want to sit down and engage with complete strangers and all of a sudden be best friends. Not to mention those engrossed in their own world, completely oblivious to everything going on around them, headphones plugged in and sound blaring. I find the whole experience quite fascinating. Indeed, it's inspired me to commence further education in the evenings. I'm taking a psychology class. I intend to use the commute for research purposes going forward, and to eventually base my thesis somehow on the many interesting things it can reveal about society.
Speaker 5.
For me, the commute is an exercise in patience, and it tests mine severely by the day. I have a very positive can-do outlook on life. I am, if you like, a doer who likes to get on with things. Therefore, the sense of inertia is painful for me. It literally feels like I'm throwing away hours of my life, time I could potentially be doing so much of something more constructive with. And I have tried to use the time wisely, but I find the commotion very distracting. Therefore, it is impossible to concentrate on anything remotely worthwhile. I feel I am the eye of the storm. All around me are nervous, fidgeting and noisy commuters who can't settle. I just close my eyes and calmly wait for it to be over, which it will be permanently, I'm pleased to say soon, on account of my imminent retirement.
Now you will hear part four again. Speaker one.
I don't mind my commute per se, despite the amount of time I spend getting to work and back each day. Some would say it is incredibly wasteful and unproductive to sit on a train for 2 hours every morning and evening. However, I think you have to make the best of every situation, and while mine is not by any means ideal, I try to use my time constructively. For example, I'm learning a language using listening aids at the moment while I commute, and this has the added bonus of distracting me from all the surrounding commotion, which I would otherwise find at times very unsettling. I am not massively at home in large crowds, but, as I said already, it is important to make the best of things, and for the foreseeable future, I am stuck with my commute. Thus, I have to cope with it as best I can until things change, maybe in a year or so.
Speaker 2.
I actually miss my old route to work now that I no longer have to catch the 6:30 train in every morning. Indeed, I'm incredibly anxious about whether or not I will lose some of the network of friends I had built up while commuting. We were commuter buddies, it was great, partners in crime and suffering together. Though for me it wasn't suffering at all, but an absolute pleasure and a wonderful opportunity to interact with people. My nerves are fraying now and I fear for my social life. All of my best mates commute and I see them much less now than I used to. It's going to take an incredible effort on my part to maintain those links, where before it was so natural. Ironically, I'll probably end up having to do a lot of commuting of a different sort, for social and not work purposes. It's the only option I have left, as my move to the city centre is permanent. After all, I bought a house here.
Speaker 3.
I am fed up of having to listen to what others are doing on the train. Has the entire world gone deaf? Is it really necessary to have your speakers turned up so loud? One day, the guy next to me is learning French, no less, and the next I'm listening to some hard rock nonsense. Sometimes I want to strangle them, really. Though that's not the most intrusive thing. Worse still is when the person beside me starts trying to start up a conversation. I'll never fathom why people think I would want to be all social on my commute to work. For starters, I'm not a morning person, so my main priority is to use the time constructively to get a bit of extra shut-eye. Otherwise, I'll arrive at work grumpy and make my work colleagues nervous. I think a permanent move closer to my place of work for a reduced commute is very necessary for my sanity, and I am taking measures as we speak to make that a reality imminently.
Speaker 4.
I'm inquisitive by nature, so I must say I find the commute to work intriguing. Seldom will you ever have the opportunity to observe and learn so much about other people and the way they behave. There are the nervous types, who are patently uncomfortable and wishing they were anywhere else. Then there are the ones who want to sit down and engage with complete strangers and all of a sudden be best friends. Not to mention those engrossed in their own world, completely oblivious to everything going on around them, headphones plugged in and sound blaring. I find the whole experience quite fascinating. Indeed, it's inspired me to commence further education in the evenings. I'm taking a psychology class. I intend to use the commute for research purposes going forward, and to eventually base my thesis somehow on the many interesting things it can reveal about society.
Speaker 5.
For me, the commute is an exercise in patience, and it tests mine severely by the day. I have a very positive can-do outlook on life. I am, if you like, a doer who likes to get on with things. Therefore, the sense of inertia is painful for me. It literally feels like I'm throwing away hours of my life, time I could potentially be doing so much of something more constructive with. And I have tried to use the time wisely, but I find the commotion very distracting. Therefore, it is impossible to concentrate on anything remotely worthwhile. I feel I am the eye of the storm. All around me are nervous, fidgeting, and noisy commuters who can't settle. I just close my eyes and calmly wait for it to be over, which it will be permanently, I'm pleased to say, soon, on account of my imminent retirement.
That is the end of part four. In the actual test, there would now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. The examiner shall remind you when there's 1 minute left, so that you're sure to finish in time.